Hi, folks. Could I have your attention and thank you, and please keep eating. And to those who will be sharing their stories, you will hear some forks and knives moving, but it's just because people are hungry, not because they're not paying attention. A couple of the things that are really great about the Clinton Global Initiative is that we receive a lot of support from a lot of really smart people. Another thing that is really tremendous is that our members are able to come together to do really creative things that make a real difference. So what we'd like to do over the next little bit of time, and as we move towards the end of the lunch, is hear from some of those. And first, we're going to hear from a woman, Judith Roden, who is the president of the Rockefeller Foundation, also a member of our advisory board, has been an ardent and effective supporter of CGI, and not only or even most meaningfully as a sponsor, but as someone who in her own right is an expert and a groundbreaker in what she has been able to do and is doing about poverty around the world. So it's with pleasure that I invite Judith up to speak to us briefly. Judith Roden.
Thanks so much, Gail. It's great to be here. This is my third Clinton Global Initiative. Next year I get the steak knives, I think. Seriously, though, I'm honored to be at this forum, and I'm inspired and so energized by your investment and enthusiasm to actually do something to remediate the underlying conditions that perpetuate poverty. I think it's revealing and very noteworthy that CGI brings us together every fall, not just to talk about our interdependent world, but actually to tackle challenges that can only be solved in an interconnected way. Education, global health, patterns of energy use, and climate change, just among a few. I feel gratified to be part of this larger conversation because we can only meet and master the insoluble, intractable challenges, really, through our collective efforts. As we bring this very important discussion down from 30,000 feet, I've been tasked with just putting a little rubber on the runway and helping to frame our discussion of poverty alleviation. I think it is the most important issue of our time because the plight of poor and vulnerable people drives so many of the economic and security challenges that we all face as global citizens, not to mention the moral challenges that we face as human beings. Perhaps the best place to start here is by recognizing poverty alleviation is not charity. It is about building capacity among the world's poorest people to support themselves and their families so that they can participate more fully in both local and global economies. Indeed, before people can realize the higher aspirations of political participation or increasing labor and land productivity, the economic growth that benefits us all, they have to meet their basic needs first. We all have an interest in empowering people with a sense of connection and obligation, not only to themselves, but to one another and to us collectively, to our shared future. And because of globalization, it is incontrovertibly clear that we all share a very interconnected future. At the Rockefeller Foundation, we believe that the script of globalization isn't fully written, and so we are working to harness its forces, to enhance opportunities, and to expand access to the benefits of globalization for more people in more places, and ensure that the negative consequences of globalization are more clearly understood and more definitively managed. Think for a moment about what's at stake. We all have an interest in making sure that slums are not breeding grounds for diseases, for pandemics. And yet UN Habitat predicts that within 3 decades, one of every 3 human beings will live in slums. We all have an interest in making sure that political and religious fanaticism don't fester in dark places, and yet these feelings are being fueled around the world. We all have an interest in making sure that everybody has the opportunity to help build our shared future. And yet the number of people living on $1 a day has grown. That said, what is so powerful about the Clinton Global Initiative is that it is geared around 2 very clear objectives, both translating innovation into action and galvanizing public will. Each is as important as the other. So simply put, We need less conversation and more action. We also need to summon the political will of governments and NGOs, the public and private sectors through partnerships and collaborations, encouraging and engaging large-scale responses that have the greatest potential to enable sustainable, robust development. Over the coming days, we're going to have the privilege of hearing from policymakers and leaders and scholars and donors from the worlds of business and government, community activism, all of whom, in their own way, are quite literally changing the world. We will shape an agenda that is focused on fighting poverty with job creation, illuminating the key connection between growing jobs and fostering hope. We will focus on forging partnerships, as I said, that will support more effective interventions. We will focus on filling the financing gap, building on the success of microfinance to tap the entrepreneurial potential of the developing world, but to expand access to other levels of capital that people will need to lift themselves out of poverty, kickstarting local economies suppressed by conflict or natural disasters, and furnishing new tools for women who comprise 70% of the people living on less than a dollar a day, to help them build, to equip them to build better lives for themselves and their families. In closing, let me say this. The risk is that we get either too enamored by all of these ideas or we become overwhelmed by how much there is to do at the expense of taking action. We already know that there are approaches that could be taken to scale, approaches that are successful, and we need to see them and understand them over the next 3 days and invest in them. That old Margaret Mead quote may have really been overused, but it is something of a truism even today. She said, "Never doubt what a small, committed group of people can do to change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." But in this room, that sentiment is real, and it frames our shared responsibility. So I urge you to listen to one another, ask questions, get involved, get invested, open your minds to new ideas and partnerships, and open your wallets for new projects. But most of all, don't doubt that you can make a difference. I know that you are precisely here because you think you can. Thank you.
That was beautiful, Judith. Thank you very much. As you all know, President Clinton has this thing about CGI where he says you really can't come unless you make a commitment. And in the first year, we had some great commitments. We did as well last year, and the idea has really caught on. What often hits the headlines is what the value of the commitments are or whether there's a big name involved. The real story we think about commitments is the partnerships that are struck and what CGI affords all of us who come from diverse backgrounds in terms of coming together and, as Judith suggests, weaving together ideas, resources, access, and actions to really come up with some innovative ideas that can change people's lives. So we're going to hear from three people who have made really remarkable commitments. We've asked them to tell their stories to you. They will be scattered around the room, and they will have mics. I think they're all set up. And first, we'd like to hear from Craig DeRoy, who's the president of the First American Corporation, to tell his story. And Craig, if you want to move in a little bit if people can't see you.
Great. Thank you all very much. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor to be here. And thanks at the outset to CGI for the opportunity to speak today, but really most importantly for the opportunity to present our commitment last year and help us see it to a successful conclusion. So let me give you a little bit of background. For those of you in the room who are just thinking about your commitment and what it might be, I don't have any secrets for you. I think the call to action is very clear, and being practical was sort of our objective. Mine started with a very practical airplane ride next to my wife, who was reading former Secretary of State Albright's book. And in the middle of that book, as I was struggling to think about what we were going to be doing as a commitment for CGI, was a passage that talked about her belief, a premise that is the lifelong work of Dr. Hernando de Soto, her belief that property rights and securing formal property rights was at the heart of poverty alleviation. So My wife nudges me and says, look at this. And, of course, an idea was born. And from that, on behalf of First American, we provided a commitment to build a land record system template that we thought could be cost-effectively deployed in developing countries to assist the process of formalizing property rights. Too much of the impoverished world holds property informally, not recognized by any legal or financial system. They can't leverage it. And if you can formalize it, you can get some simple things, a mailing address, as well as some more esoteric things, use that property for collateral for loans, and have real asset accumulation and wealth building. So we started from really a base of very little knowledge in this area. Our businesses dovetailed with the commitment, but we really didn't know what we were doing. We got into it, just sort of dove in, and thanks again to CGI and the staff and their guidance, we really sort of found our way to some wonderful partners. Using the CGI calling card, and believe me, it is a very effective calling card, we found three world-class partners to help us in this initiative. But we got to a point very quickly. It was a multi-year commitment, and our build-out of this template occurred much quicker than we thought. We were really completed with the first draft in about 9 months. Having done that, we also learned in the process that others had attempted similar initiatives in the past, but governments were very slow to adopt these systems and actually put them in action. So a new idea dawned, and we self-expanded our commitment to include the development of not just the land record system template, but the practical use of it, to actually team up with a microfinance lender and have them issue loans based on that land record system. And I'm really delighted to say that CGI did provide the means by which we could attract such wonderful partners. So we have three partners. ILS, International Land Systems, Peter Rabley, their CEO has taken personal interest. They are a leading provider of land record system development and administration, and it's wonderful to see the commitment from that company to help us in this project. Second is ESRI, ESRI. They are the premier provider of GIS and mapping technology around the world. Most of the cars you drive that have mapping systems in them all were founded on the software from this company. Jack Dangermond, their CEO, again, taken personal interest and leads his team in this project. They're providing a very cost-effective, technologically driven mapping of these properties in developing countries. And most importantly, our financial lending partner, Opportunity International. Chris Crane, CEO, who's seated over here. Chris, if you raise your hand. Opportunity has been a tremendous partner. They're a premier microfinance lender in their own right. They have almost 1 million borrowers in Africa today. They have a savings and loan. They have insurance programs. They're a nonprofit and a very responsible organization. And he was captured by the idea of trying to do something practical with this result and actually issue loans. So we have now committed to, we've extended our commitment to a demonstration pilot. We've targeted Ghana. It will be our first country. We've been working with the Minister of Lands in Ghana. And there's a public-private partnership element of this that has already emerged, because we will be actually early next year having Opportunity International will be issuing the first loans, microfinance mortgage loans, really in the form of equity loans, based on property descriptions generated through this process. We're delighted with the team. We're delighted with the progress and the prospects for this. And we believe that this holds the future. If we can show through this demonstration pilot, we can go back to the government and accelerate a process that seems to be stuck and have been stuck for many years. And again, CGI has afforded the forum for this, sort of the spark to get us going, the forum to have the discussion, and the resources really to help us over the hurdle. Additional public-private support has come because of the introductions by CGI to Secretary of State Albright, to Dr. Hernando de Soto, who we met with several times, including one meeting yesterday. They co-chair the UN Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor, and they've adopted this really as a personal project of their own. They really have supported us, given us guidance, and we appreciate all of that. And again, that's thanks to CGI and all of its resources. So I would just like to say that technology is sort of at the heart of all this, and all of our partners are using it, leveraging it. One thing I'd like to show as a demonstrable evidence of that is this card. Opportunity International has sort of pioneered the use of a card that's very much like every ATM or credit card we have. It's embedded with fingerprint identification of the borrower, so there can be no use of the card or misuse of the card. It holds all of their personal information today. It holds their current savings account and their current micro loan information. Soon it will hold their property information, and it will hold the balance of their loan secured by that property. So we're thrilled by this progress. We're thrilled by our partners. As we move into phases 3 and 4, which is to take this demonstration pilot, which we believe will be about 100 loans, and we'll be able to showcase this process, as we move it out into the marketplace and create a more sustainable model, we're looking for new partners as well. So if you have an interest in this, I'd like to make one brief solicitation, and please find me throughout the conference. We would love to work with you and at least hear what you might have by way of an idea. So thanks for the opportunity to talk to the group.
And I, one of the great things about this is it was an idea. It took shape, and now it's being applied. And we wish you the best of luck in Ghana. And I'm thankful to you for mentioning technology. Last year, one of our panelists was a woman named Kristen Peterson, who's the chair and co-founder of Invenio. And we talked to her about speaking, and she was quite excited, and she was a great speaker. And she got to work on a commitment. And we've asked her to tell her story about how a commitment was realized and has grown over the last year. So, Kristen, the floor is yours.
Hello, everybody. Is it working? Yes. Hello, everybody. I'm Kristen Peterson, and I'm with an organization called Invenio. When I spoke last year on the panel, I talked about how access to technology can, in remote and rural areas, can have a profound effect in a very simple ways that we in the developed world take for granted every day. Access to technology can mean better health care in rural areas. It can mean access to market information or communications for a farmer to make additional income. And it can mean access to a brighter future through education for children and adults in the developing world. Invenio is a nonprofit social enterprise whose mission is to get the tools of technology out to organizations and people who need it most, primarily remote and rural areas in the developing world. Our work now is primarily in Africa. How we do that, just to give you background on our commitment, is that we create technology solutions, ultra-low power computers that can be powered by solar, long-distance wireless that can be used to reach access to the Internet. We create these solutions all for organizations who operate in remote and rural areas, providing vital services, education, healthcare, relief, and economic development, and communications through telecenters. And we were very honored as a young organization, as a startup organization, to participate in the dialogue about how technology can change lives in the developing world. And through our experience with several installations that we had worked on to date, what we had found was that technology is not enough to make a difference. Infrastructure is not enough. We could create the infrastructure, the technological infrastructure, but we needed to build the human infrastructure, local human infrastructure, to deliver, install, and support technology for these organizations in rural areas. And so we made a stretch goal as a small organization to put a 3-year program in place to build a core of IT engineers, ICT engineers, and entrepreneurs, essentially small businesses, into place by recruiting, training existing professionals that typically operate in urban areas, enabling them to have the skills and the tools necessary to build out access to ICTs, computers, the Internet, telephony in rural areas. And through CGI, specifically, the day I was able to speak, we were able to meet Cisco Systems, who committed to help build out this program. And as well, we met AMD. I see Dan Shine over there. And we had actually been working with both Cisco and AMD on separate projects, but we were able to meet and make that breakthrough about how you can scale, how we can scale access to, or scale local, scale education, and to really create the scale of access that can make a huge difference. And so we were able to raise about almost $500,000 to build this program, and we launched it this year. We now are on track this year to have 17 local IT partners in Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, South Africa, Guinea-Bissau, and a couple of other countries that we're working on, most likely Cameroon and a few others. And together with Invenio and our local partners, we're reaching over 70 communities and over 200,000 people with life-impacting technologies. And we hope to deliver these solutions with our local partners and to reach thousands of communities and millions of people with access to these technologies. I'd like to bring it down to a very specific example of how technology and how this partner program can alleviate poverty. We just kicked off our first education program. We recruited technologists in Rwanda, and we took them out on a site where we were building, where we were taking an existing computer center in a very rural school. And this school had had this computer center for 2 years, thanks to Cisco and the NEPAD initiative. And we were taking it and turning it into a solar-powered school with ultra-low-powered computers so that it could be more sustainable and extendable for the community. What happened was that we met Alex, our team met Alex, a young gentleman who had just graduated. He had access to these computers for 2 years. He showed so much promise that we invited him to join our training session with our local partners. And the local partners, so the technology in and of itself, access to computers, really opened up his eyes to new opportunities just to begin with. And then working with the local partners, he met someone from one of the two leading technology universities in Rwanda. And they're now working to get him a scholarship so that he can pursue his dream of helping bring ICTs out to places like his. That's not the only impact. They're considering hiring him now to open up this community, computer center to the local community. And until he's ready to go to college in a year, it's his gap year, we're hoping that they will fund him to make this center available at nights and on weekends so that the community can get trained on computers and can get access to the same kind of impacting technology he has. So all of these efforts have been thanks to creating this program through CGI and through the organizations that we've met through CGI, AMD, and Cisco. In fact, I'd like to share that already this year, as of Friday, both Cisco Systems and Lottomatica have come forward and offered to help us scale this program through next year. And so we can start to take it throughout Africa and continue to bring these vital technologies to people so they can use them to change their lives. Thank you.
Thank you, and it's very nice of people to thank CGI, but I think what we really do is provide a platform, and then people do amazing things. Now, by the end of CGI, typically, and I can say this having done this since the beginning, there's a real momentum that builds, and extraordinary commitments have been announced, and great people have spoken, and people have connected. Those of us who work on it are kind of at the point where we wonder if we're hallucinating or really hearing what we're hearing because we haven't slept in several days. And there is a really terrific final plenary, which you'll see again this year, where President Clinton, at his best, sums it all up. And last year, this one gentleman who's a very famous man in his own right, a leader in business, gets written up all the time, he's as smart as they come, stepped up to the plate and put the icing on the cake. We thought we were done. We thought we'd heard all the commitments. And this gentleman got seized by the moment and put together something that is having a huge impact in transforming a country that's been through more than its share of hardship. So I would like to invite up to tell his story, Robert Johnson.
Thanks, Gail, for that kind introduction, and good afternoon. Gail is absolutely correct. Last year, as those of you who were here know, President Johnson Sirleaf, the first female president elected in Africa, spoke at the Global Initiative. And I was moved not only by the clarity of her message and the force of her convictions, but by the unique relationship that exists between the United States and Liberia, and particularly African Americans. And it was evident to me that President Sirleaf wanted our help in rebuilding her nation. As you know, Liberia had emerged from anywhere between 12 to 15 years of civil war, had lost up to 10% of its population of 3 million. If you can imagine the parallel, if that had been that type of loss in a country like the United States, the magnitude of the number. Complete devastation of the infrastructure, loss of momentum in education for young people, health care, all the necessary ingredients of an orderly society. And so, given that President Sirleaf wanted to revitalize Liberia's private sector, because she was an accountant by training, she understands the role of the private sector in generating jobs and income, attracting investment, and stimulating sustained economic growth of a nation that desperately needed it. And what happened, again, as Gail pointed out, the spur of the moment, a group of African Americans who were at the initiative, two of whom are here today with me, and I want to introduce and make and have them stand up, were moved by that momentum. And the two people I'm referring to who are here are best known, obviously, for their tremendous credentials and talent in the film industry, but they're also equally as engaged and involved in humanitarian efforts. The first is the terrific actor Jeffrey Wright. And the wonderful and beautiful Ms. Cicely Tyson. What we, along with the others, did was to make a commitment to mobilize $30 million in support of Liberia's private sector, to take a business delegation to that country and put in place an ongoing advocacy effort to ensure that Liberia receives all the support possible from the United States. My colleagues and I took that commitment seriously. And it's because of this special relationship. If you think about Liberia, when I went over there with Ambassador Booth, met the U.S. Ambassador Booth, he told me, he said, Bob, I've been posted to at least 9 foreign countries. And there's no country that I've been in that I feel more comfortable and more proud when I stick that U.S. flag on the bumper of my car and travel around than the welcome that I receive from the people of Liberia. The Liberians, in short, love America. And part of it is because of this unique relationship. They have the parallels are all over the place. They have a House and a Senate. The flag is red, white, and blue with a star in it. And even the capital, Monrovia, is named after President James Monroe. So if they could, they'd love to be annexed as a state. And so it was that kind of commitment that we felt in supporting Liberia, and we modeled it, and we want to model this advocacy commitment on the same kind of commitment that we feel that the American Jewish community has for Israel and other nationalities have for their homeland. And so we take this matter seriously. So it was really great for me that on February 15th in Washington, D.C., at a donors conference, we announced the creation of the $30 million RLJ Liberia Enterprise Development Fund. This fund is a partnership between my company, the RLJ Companies, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the American NGO CHF International, and the U.S. African Development Fund. Within the next several weeks from today, the fund will start making loans of $25,000 to $500,000 to Liberian businesses and will offer technical assistance to those businesses who need help to get credit worthy. And believe me, $25,000, $30,000 is a lot of money in Liberia in its current state. In April of last year, we took a 25-person trade and cultural mission to Liberia, whose participants included some of the leading African Americans in fields of business, aviation, entertainment, health, and education. And interestingly enough, that trade mission was the first by a group of Americans of any stripe to Liberia in over 25 years. And the one thing that I came back struck from that trip, and part of it was it showed me the urgency of the problem that President Sirleaf faced. If you remember 15 years of civil war, a whole generation of young men not working, engaged in horrible fighting. And her challenge is to find a way to make these young men productive before some way they find to become destructive. And it's vitally important that we help her in this mission. It's a country where perhaps less than 10% of Monrovia is electrified. It's a country that still requires 2,000 UN peacekeepers. But at the same time, it's a country with tremendous hope and a desire to never, ever descend into the darkness of civil war. And it's vitally important that we, particularly those of here in the United States, help make sure that never happens. So what we did on our advocacy effort, we got back, we wrote opinion articles to national newspapers that were reprinted talking about our experience in Liberia. We met with senior government officials, both in the Congress and in the administration, to press the point that Liberia deserves the support. And our work generated results. For example, many Liberians who had been here, escaped from civil war, were due to be deported to return home. Well, the country, in many cases, is not ready to receive the people who are going to be asked to return home. In addition, the country would lose the millions of dollars in remittances that go back home from these individuals here in the States. So we were able to get an extension for 3,500 Liberians from being expelled from the United States for 18 months. We also got Liberia on the short list of African nations that are being considered by the Defense Department and the U.S. government for something called the Africa Command. President Sirleaf believes that this command will not only help stabilize Liberia politically, but will also add significant economic investment to Liberia from the creation of that command. In addition, we've ensured that financial assistance flows to the training of a new security force. Our fear is that if another hotspot pops up in Africa or some other part of the world, and the UN strapped for peacekeepers decides that they're going to pull 2,000 peacekeepers out of Liberia, Liberia's police and military is not trained sufficiently to protect that country in case there's some minor, whether it's a civil uprising of some kind or some other kind of political upheaval. And so it's vitally important that the United States commit the funds to train the police force and the Liberian army. The other thing we were successful in doing, for a long time, because of Liberia was in civil war under the Charles Taylor regime, Liberia was on the watch list by the State Department, by the Congress, before aid could flow. Aid would flow, but it had to be vetted each time by the various committees of the Senate before it would flow. This delay in getting aid to a country that desperately needed was a particular problem that President Sirleaf wanted to have relieved. And I'm proud to say that we now have it so that Liberia is no longer on the same list as countries like Sudan and Zimbabwe in terms of the flow of aid. And it's vitally important. So while we've made progress in fulfilling our commitments, we realize there's much to do. What sustains us is a challenge of making a positive and contribution to as many Liberians as possible and contributing to the deepening and strengthening of the relationship between our two countries. And I encourage you to be bold in your commitments and invite you to join us in our work of support for President Sirleaf and the reconstruction of Liberia. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. And I will tell you, when I got back to my real job after CGI last year, my assistant in right arm, whose family is from Liberia, said, "Did you see what Bob Johnson and those people did? That was so cool, and it makes me feel proud." So thank you for that. Our last speaker here today is a special guest, and I think a man who has shown a lot of us across this country and around the world that poverty is something much bigger than all of us, that it doesn't matter what we think about Social Security, doesn't matter what we think about the war in Iraq, that ultimately what matters is that we're all committed to bringing economic justice to people around the world. He's a man I had the pleasure of meeting a year ago, and a man who has taken the notion of commitment and translated it for real people, both at home and abroad. So it's my pleasure to introduce, as our last speaker, Pastor Rick Warren from Saddleback Church.
Well, thank you for caring. You know, it always starts in the heart. Nothing happens till you get moved. And thank you for your commitments. Nothing happens without commitment. I look around this room and I see so many friends like Chris Crane and Bill Hybels and others who have built enormous outreaches to the needy because of commitment. And really, most of all, I want to thank you for your willingness to partner, because there are some problems in the world that are so big, you have to triple tackle them. You cannot do it on your own. When one drop of rain falls, it makes no difference at all. But you get a million drops of rain falling, you can turn a desert into a forest. And the willingness to partner is, I believe, at the root of why we haven't solved these problems already. People willing to put aside the things that they differ on and work together on the things that they agree on. Last year, I spoke at Davos, the World Economic Forum, and I kept hearing people talking about we need public and private partnerships. And that's true. But if all there was that was needed was government and business, then we would have already done it by now. It actually takes a three-legged stool for there to be stability. A one-legged stool will fall over. A two-legged stool will fall over. You have to have three legs. And if we are going to team tackle these big issues like poverty, disease, illiteracy, trafficking, corruption, and so many other issues, we're going to somehow have to tap into the largest pool of volunteer manpower in the world. It's two-thirds of the world. It's called the people of faiths, plural. There are 600 million Buddhists in the world. That's a large number. There are 800 million Hindus in the world. There are 1 billion Muslims in the world. There are 2.3 billion Christian members of churches. Now, as a pastor, of course, I'm interested in the last one, but they all matter. They all matter. When I think about 2.3 billion people who say they're a member of a church somewhere, that makes the church bigger than China. That makes the church bigger than India. In fact, it makes the church bigger than China and India put together. Now, if you want to say, well, we can't have anybody of any faith doing humanitarian effort, you just ruled out most of the world. Because really, outside of Manhattan and Europe, there aren't really that many secularists. Okay? The fact is, most people have some kind of faith. Well, it doesn't matter to me what it is at that point, but if they're willing to work on the issues, that's what matters. And so I believe that there's a government role, and there is a business role, and there is a faith role. Governments have things that only they can do, as was pointed out earlier, property rights, protections of freedoms, providing opportunities for economic growth, paving roads, infrastructure. There's so many things that only government can do. Businesses have roles that can only business can do. The expertise that they bring to healthcare and the expertise that they bring in agriculture and management, since both businesses, most governments, and most churches are poorly managed. the bringing cash and capital. There is a role. But you maybe have never thought about this. There are things that churches can provide in dealing with poverty, disease, illiteracy that nobody else will ever have. Some of the biggest problems have to do with issues like distribution, manpower, credibility at the local level, and boots on the ground. When it comes to distribution, I could take you to 10 million villages around the world. The only thing in it's a church. It is the most widespread network in the world. Nothing else comes close. You could put all the Walmarts and Starbucks and McDonald's together. They don't come close to the millions and millions and millions of churches or other houses of worship. I have traveled around the world a lot. Last year I did a 46-day tour to 45,000 miles around the world, which means around more than once. And in every country I went in, I would meet with the president and the government leaders. I'd meet with the business leaders and meet with the church leaders and say, can we follow that great theologian Rodney King and just get along? Can we not work together on the things that matter and make a difference? And as I said, once you get outside of the capital of most countries around the world, there is no government. And the only civil service structure is faith in many parts of the world, whether it's a church or a mosque or a temple or something. And so they have the largest distribution. The boots are already on the ground. We proved that in the last year or so in both the Katrina hurricanes and in the tsunami. The churches were first on the scene and they were the last out. My own church gave well over $3 million to those two issues and sending teams by the large numbers. The second thing people of faith have, not just universal distribution, they have the largest manpower of volunteers. Nobody comes close to the hundreds of millions of people who volunteer through their Jewish congregation, Muslim congregation, Christian congregation, or whatever, around the world on a weekly basis. The third thing that they have is they have local credibility. Because in that village, the people trust that pastor, that priest, that minister, that imam, that rabbi, far more than they do anybody else. Because he's there in the marrying and the burying, in the stages of life. One of the countries we're working in, Rwanda. You know, when the genocide came in, all the NGOs left, but the church stayed. Why? It is the people. You can't talk about community development without talking about people who are part of faith communities. So my commitment was about 4 years ago, I said, how could we mobilize? What if we mobilized a billion of those 2 billion in just my faith, in Christianity, to make a difference? And we decided we would do a pilot project that we called the PEACE program. And PEACE is an acronym, P-E-A-C-E, and it stands for Promote Reconciliation, Equip Leaders, Assist the Poor, Care for the Sick, and Educate the Next Generation. We've been quietly behind the scenes testing this prototype for 4 years now, trying to build a plane as we wrote it. I, in my own church, have had over 7,500 of my members have been overseas in the last 3 years, working in 68 countries. Poverty alleviation. And by the way, the only way you get rid of poverty is spelled J-O-B-S. It's jobs. As I do believe that when you simply subsidize people, you rob their dignity, and you make them dependent. People don't need a handout. They need a hand up. They need trade, not aid. They need skills. Because they're smart. They just need the opportunities the rest of us have. And it's not really a charity issue. It's a justice issue. And so these people have been going out, 7,500 people all around the world, testing in, I said, 68 countries. And now we have just come back and we have been studying all the data and we learned everything that doesn't work. So if you'd like to know what doesn't work on a local level, see me. I'm a pro at what doesn't work. Because we've tested and tested and tested and tested. And we just, 2 weeks ago, launched what we call PEACE 2.0. One of the things that we learned is that other people, groups besides churches, said, hey, we'd like to do that. We'd like to partner. We'd like to promote reconciliation and equip leaders and assist the poor and care for the sick and educate the next generation. And I said, well, there's an idea here of the three-legged stool, where business has a role and profits have a role and faith has a role. You see, honestly, I don't care what your motivation is for helping people, as long as you do it. It doesn't have to be my motivation, as long as you do it. I'm a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, and I happen to know that when we help other nations, that's good foreign policy. I've learned that when you help people get well, like if they've got AIDS and they get well, they like your country. So there's a good political motivation for it. It's not my motivation, but there's no problem with that. It's just a good motivation. There are businesses who do it for a profit motivation. We say we want to provide pharmaceuticals, make a profit, and help people. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, I wish more organizations did it. I wish more people would make a profit and do good at the same time. It's not my motivation, but it's a good one. Some people do what they do because of a personal motivation. I do it because I have a Savior called Jesus Christ who said, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, that doesn't have to be your motivation for me to work with you. It's just my motivation. I am told to love my neighbor as myself. And so I have found that faith organizations are far more willing to partner with NGOs and governments than vice versa. And I'm saying it's not going to get done unless you get all three legs of the stool. Thank you.
Okay, so you've got the experience and the messages. Let's just all go out and do it. Now, I mean that literally, go out. We need to clear this room fairly quickly so we can get set up for the first panel, which starts in half an hour. You will also find the people to help you on the sign-ups for breakfast discussions. So with many thanks and particular thanks to all of our speakers who have caught it absolutely perfectly. It's about partnership and doing what we can together. Please, together, leave the room and come back in half an hour. Thank you very much.